Morning, everyone. Awake and ready?
Awake and ready.
Great. Let us pray, O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only King.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Peaceless. Amen. So lovely to be here with you all this morning. This past 27th, we celebrated Guru Purnima Day, and it's the full moon that occurs in June or July and is meant to mark the gratitude and the honoring of Guru and Guru lineage. And from the posting this morning, it reads, Guru Purnima is honoring one's Guru and Guru lineage. Guru, of course, is not a word many of us grew up with, but it has entered the common lexicon since the 1960s and 70s. Now we have Wall Street gurus, communication gurus. Anyone who has extraordinary talent in their field can be identified as such. This generalization is not all inappropriate, for anyone who brings light to a field of knowledge meets the qualification. However, the title takes on a more specific and refined meaning in the spiritual field. A spiritual guru, one who brings light into darkness. He can be one who teaches a more intellectual course of study, but as you rise higher, it is the rare person of realization that can fulfill the true role of guru. A realized being has risen to and gained mastery of the various spinal centers that represent specific levels of consciousness. The first level concerns basic quest for life and survival. Surrender of one's life in service to God and Guru, God and humanity is a means to rise above this initial level. Then comes desire for pleasure and sex instinct that is meant for the survival of the species. This is nature's way of perpetuating humanity. Humanly, we can learn to imbue this energy with love, dedication, and beauty by a husband and wife, taking it out of the gross and indiscriminate nature into which it can devolve. But that same energy can be used for the higher purpose, for gaining realization and service to God. Rather than merely fulfilling basic urges and sense satisfaction, the transmutation of these energies is the key to attaining mastery over the second chakra or energy center. Climbing higher in the spinal ladder, one comes to the evolutionary development of individual will. Here one learns to submit one's own will to divine will through spiritual dedication. Initially, an aspirant abides by spiritual laws handed down in religious traditions and through spiritual teachers. As the mind is purified, direct intuition of divine will becomes possible, and through submission to God's direction, spiritual mastery is gained in the third chakra. The heart center signifies going beyond strictly individual concerns and growing into a larger world. Humanly, loving another and the willingness to sacrifice for others, a loved one, children, friends, or the larger world community is a primer to divine love. Divine love is experienced with the opening of the fourth chakra at the heart, and there divine love flows out to one and all in an unfettered way. The experience of divine love is purifying in itself and prepares the aspirant to give oneself, heart, and soul to divine love, transcending the personal individual and entering into the impersonal transcendent. The fifth chakra concerns knowing what right conduct is based on higher truth. Initially, this is known through a quickening of the mind that makes you know this is correct and this is not. Submission in thought, word, and deed to this higher knowledge makes you become Dharma itself and prepares you for more perfect attunement to inborn Dharma, direct apprehension of truth. This attunement is your initiation for entering into the sixth chakra, otherwise known as Kutastha Chaitanya, or Christ consciousness. In Christ consciousness, there is a more perfect union with the divine mind. Love and intelligence are both informed by a steady stream from the pure mind of Father God. The individual is practicing perfect surrender in body, mind, and soul, and the power of God flows freely through such a one. In this stage, there is still the sense of I and thou, a thin but definite veil of division between human and divine. The Son of Man, or the human consciousness, surrenders completely to the divine essence and is willing to go through whatever God desires. Through these experiences in the mystical crucifixion or the battle of Kurukshetra, the veil of separation is pierced. When the process is complete, there is only knowing oneness with God. This oneness is emerging into the seventh chakra at the top of the head. The tall headgear or hats of religious heads is symbol of fully opened seventh chakra. Depictions of the Buddha shows three coils of hair above the top of his head, indicating mastery over the three bodies, the physical, astral, and causal, and being established in this highest center. This is a summa cum laude for the yogi or spiritual master. Mother called this going over the top. Once the individual has been completely subsumed into the spiritual, then the spiritual may once again manifest as the individual. Only now it is all done in complete accordance with all the purity of spiritual consciousness manifesting through the human, the complete God-man or God-woman. According to Meher Baba, a master of the fifth chakra and above may function as a guru, not before. In some rare cases, the guru may have gone all the way, and having gone over the top may serve to help others to do the same. Large followings are not the sign of a more advanced guru. A Mahayogi such as Babaji may have only a few disciples at a time, but each aspirant has earned their position. Even then, their full realization is not guaranteed, for free will is always in play until complete illumination is achieved. True gurus, such as Mother and Master, do what they do out of compassion and a desire to help others to know. We are the direct beneficiaries of these benevolent beings who spend their lives bringing spiritual light to this world. Oftentimes, those who the guru seeks to help are not able to fully take advantage of what they are given. But even though the guru wants realization for all aspirants here and now, they also have the understanding that each soul comes with their own karma and purity of desire. A few may fully take what is given, others just a portion, and some may walk away empty-handed, not because they are not freely given, but because the individual is not yet ready to embark upon the great adventure. So we honor the guru and the guru lineage for what has been given. We make certain we are not the poor workman blaming his tools, but really go to work and be fully engaged with the truth and the Guru Shakti that the powerful Guru gives. We strive to take the light that has been freely given, and in return, give the light we now know within to all the world in all that we do. For to really honor the Guru means that you do not that you do what he or she asks you to do, to give as he or she gives, to emulate the Guru in all the important ways, to be an emissary of truth. There is no greater way to honor the Guru. I wanted to read to you an email that I received this morning from a sincere devotee. And it starts out with a quote from Sri Ramakrishna. The roof is clearly visible, but it is extremely hard to reach. But if someone who has already reached drops down a rope, he can pull another person up. That's from Ramakrishna. To the divine Sadguru and our masters of self-realization, born of this infinite compassion, the courage and sacrifice of your lives makes possible the advancement of this world. Ever in divine bliss is your sweetest pleasure to bear the load of suffering humanity. What a gift of our beautiful God to come as such beautiful gurus. What can we give to those who keep nothing for themselves? Sincerity and loyalty. All the sincerity, all the loyalty of our hearts and our souls forever and forever. By our own striving, may each moment be an offering dedicated to those who have given their lives so that we may live. Om Kod Christ Gurus. I think that's beautiful. Reading from Yogananda's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. And Master writes, the practical metaphysician in the in the course of his attempts to free his soul from the material bondage learns the exact methods for victory. By consistently right thoughts and actions in harmony with divine law, the soul of man ascends slowly the course of natural evolution. The yogi, however, chooses to quicken evolution, hastening method, scientific meditation, by which the flow of consciousness is reversed from matter to spirit, through the same cerebral spinal centers of life and divine consciousness that channeled the soul's descent into the body. Even the novitiate meditator quickly finds that he is able to draw upon the spiritual power and consciousness of the inner world of soul and spirit to enlighten his bodily kingdom and activities, physical, mental, and spiritual. The more adept he becomes, the greater the divine influence. As the yogi's consciousness moves ever upward from body consciousness to cosmic consciousness, he experiences the following. First, by the practice of the guru-given meditation, the aspiring yogi is strengthened in his resolve to find God through self-realization. He no longer wishes to remain identified with worldliness, subject to the limitations of the body and the delusion of nature's opposites of life, death, joy, sorrow, health, disease. With newly awakened discrimination, the yogi is able to free his consciousness from egoistic attachments to the earthly possessions and his little circle of friends. His motive is not limited and negative, one of denial, but a natural expression toward all inclusiveness. He serves limiting he severs limiting mental attachments that they stand not in the way of his perception of omnipresent. After achieving this goal, the love of the perfect yogi includes not only his own family and friends, but all mankind. And so here Master outlines what we're aiming for. We start out in the Bible with the story of the Garden of Eden, and in it we are told about Adam and Eve. Adam represents reason. Eve represents feeling. And these are the two natures that we come into this world with. And they walk in harmony with God. Every day they are in this garden, the Garden of Eden. Now this garden is your human body. And that they are able to walk in perfect communion with God all the time. But, so the story goes, the serpent enters in. And the serpent is the life force that is in the spine. If you'll notice, in this Old Testament story, the serpent is the deceiver, is the one who draws consciousness down the spine or the tree of consciousness within you. And then when you go into the New Testament and how Jesus speaks of the serpent, it's all in positive terms. And that is because the serpent has been turned upward through the spine. The life energy is drawn up from the lower centers into the higher centers of the spine and the brain. So this is a tremendous devolution and then evolution of the man. Because we start out in that perfected consciousness. And you think, well, if we're so perfect in that consciousness, why is it that we ever choose to come into this body, to identify with this body and this world, and to limit ourselves in this way and cut ourselves off from God consciousness? And of course, this is one of the great mysteries, but the soul is on a great adventure. It feels like it wants to explore what it is to be human. It gets drawn down into the body, and it doesn't completely understand at that time all the consequences of its decisions. But it chooses, we have chosen at some point in our evolution, to identify with this body. We can be in this body and not be of this body, even as we can be in this world, but not of this world. But through this choice that we make, and that symbolically Adam and Eve make, they listen to the serpent force that draws us down into identification with this body. And so we start on to this adventure into this life of the body, and with it, we become subject to the laws of this world. The laws of this world is what is called karma. And as you sow, so shall you reap. As you do, so it comes back to you. As Newton said in one of his laws, that for every action, there is an opposite and equal reaction. And this is true in the spiritual, just as much as it is in the physical. And so we act more and more out of attachment to this body, which generates an ego consciousness. Ego is that which is separate from God. And so we make choices, we get into delusion, we get more and more confused, we get more and more attached. And as a result of that, we completely lose our way. And some more than others. Some live a relatively pure life in this body. And they don't attract as much karma to themselves than others get addicted to drugs and to alcohol, to sex, to accumulation of things in this world. And that becomes their be-all and their end-all. And it's like being on a ship that's sinking. Eventually it's going to go down because this body will one day cease to exist. And everything is banked upon having pleasure and avoidance of pain in this body. And so, as a result of that, this life is suffering. And that was the Buddha's first noble truth. Life is suffering. And that is because we identify with this body, and this body will ultimately betray us. And so it doesn't feel like that in the beginning. In the beginning, and for much of our lives, it can feel like we live forever. But gradually, the specter of death begins to dawn upon us. And as it does, we realize that we all have an expiry date. That date comes sooner for some and later for others, but it comes for everybody. And so this comes with knowledge. But it doesn't always bring wisdom. Sometimes we're just afraid that we are going to die. We cling all the tighter to the things of this world as if it is everything, because that's the way that it feels. But gradually, through the evolution of our consciousness, we come to that point where we identify the source of the problem, and the problem is this, that we live in this state of separation, and as a result of that, we suffer from lifetime to lifetime. Now, we don't always remember our previous lifetimes, but neither do we remember even the first 5, 6, 7 years of our life. It all becomes a fog to us. We may have glimpses of memories and snapshots, but we don't have complete and total recall. As we dive deeper in meditation, sometimes we're given complete lifetimes. They unfold in an instant, and suddenly we remember who we were and what we did, or we're given a certain highlight, because oftentimes there's something that we did in a previous lifetime that relates to this lifetime, and it explains why this is such a difficulty. We have different fears that come to us. We may have fears of heights or fears of snakes or other kinds of things, and yet we've never fallen from a great height in this lifetime. We've never been bitten and died from a snake bite. And still we have this built-in fear. Now sometimes we get it from the environment. Sometimes we get it from our parents or those people who are close to us, around us. But there are certain things that are just inexplicable. And when we go deeper into our consciousness and we recover some of these memories, then we understand that we had a particular traumatic episode in a previous life. And because of that, that registers it deeply in the subconscious mind. And so it is a struggle in this lifetime, even though we don't remember the original cause, still we have the effect that reverberates in our own subconscious mind. And we are here to free ourselves from all those limitations, from all the fears, from all of the attachments. And so we start on a spiritual path genuinely. Sometimes we're awakened by a certain experience. We're lifted up and we see ourselves in a brand new light. We see ourselves as a spiritual being. It's just a gift that is given to us. And we understand that this body is not the be-all, end-all. We know ourselves to be something more, and yet we return back down into what we might say normal state of consciousness, our human state, a state of separation, and this sets us on to the path. Other times, we're just given a spiritual crisis. We are put into a state of spiritual misery, you might say, where we're not satisfied with the things of this world. And this is certainly true for me. I was in my late teens, and I looked around and I looked at all the adults in my life, and I couldn't see anybody that I wanted to emulate, somebody that I wanted to be like. It all seemed to have a certain kind of emptiness to me. And as a result of this, I started to look about and cast about. What's this life for? Why am I here? What's my purpose? How do I find happiness? Because I was only in misery at the time. And I didn't have any automatic responses. Earlier in my life, when I was 12 years old, I had been raised in the Methodist Church. And I didn't have any particular bad experiences, anything like that. But I came to the realization, because when you're around 12 years old, your reasoning mind begins to develop further in your brain development. And mine did, and I reasoned it out. And I thought, what I'm being told is that only those who have accepted Jesus Christ will be saved. But what about all of those people in India and in China and other places in Africa, places where people have never even heard of Jesus before? What about all of those thousands of years that people existed before Jesus even came into existence? And I thought of all this, and I thought, that's not even a very good plan, much less a perfect plan. What about all of those souls? Are they expected at the end to give up everything they've ever been taught, everything they've ever known? And so I rejected those teachings, but I couldn't accept anything new. Nothing made total sense to me. And for a while, I thought science was the way to have the answers. And so I was very interested in physics and subatomic particles and so on, and was reading books, and I had some friends who were also interested. And so we were exploring this, but it didn't take too long to bump up against these bigger questions. What is the purpose behind all this? Why is that? And the science department immediately sends you down to the philosophy department. And the philosophy department didn't seem to have all that good answers either. Nothing that satisfied me. And so my quest had to continue on. And then I took some dark turns. And something that I wouldn't recommend to anybody. And my misery grew and grew and grew. And finally, it catapulted me into a complete spiritual breakdown crisis. And I had nowhere to turn. I had nowhere else to go. And so I finally turned to God, because I was absolutely desperate. And I had no idea whether God existed or not. But I prayed to God. It was a night that was filled with stars, and I was just in this pure misery. And I said, God, I don't know if you exist, but if you do, if I have never needed you before, I need you now. And immediately I felt as if 1,000 pounds was lifted off my shoulders. And I felt myself to have some peace. And immediately my mind went to work, and I thought, well, I was expecting some kind of result, and my mind just made something up. And then I thought about it more deeply, and I thought, no, that's not true. I know something has happened. I don't know what it is, but it was definitely in response to this prayer. And I want to pursue whatever that is, because this is pretty terrific, whatever I've been given here. And so it put me onto a path. And I wasn't interested in learning a complex philosophy or new language or any of those kinds of things at all. I had been reading about and studying more Eastern religious texts and ideas and stories. And this is what inspired me the most. But I wasn't out to adopt any particular religion. I wanted God experience, because that's the only thing that would offer relief. Because as soon after this uplifting experience, I was cast back down again. And so there I was in that misery. Now, I considered that the greatest travesty of all at the time. Now I considered a great blessing, because I wondered, why can't I enjoy life just the way other people seem to be able to enjoy their lives? They're going on to college at this point that I was in my life. Some of them are getting married and starting families. And none of that has any appeal for me. I can't see my happiness going in that direction. And so I continued to strive. And then one day I read a book, and it was about a man who met a guru. Now, I didn't really know what a guru was then. And there is something in his description that when he met his guru, tears were just pouring down his eyes, and he just felt like he had come home for the first time. And I thought, that's interesting. I didn't have any kind of notion that I would necessarily have that kind of reaction to meeting somebody. But it made sense to me that if I wanted to make progress on this path, on this journey that I felt myself to be on, that it made sense to meet somebody who had already been the way. You know, if you want to learn about a particular area of study, you might go to college and you might go to have classes with certain professors. And they have expertise, and that makes sense. Or if you wanted to learn some kind of a skill, you would meet somebody who had already attained a level of mastery at that skill. That made sense to do all of that. Well, why wouldn't you do the same thing in the spiritual life? And so it made sense to me to meet somebody who had already been the way. So I met different ones who had said that they had attained some spiritual mastery. One was a Sikh guru, and he came to town and gave a talk, and I listened to him. And I was not that plussed. I was taking a hatha yoga class through some of his students, and I just didn't feel drawn in that way. And then there were some others, and I went to a psychic camp, what's called a psychic camp. It was these cabins, and they had different people who said to be channeling psychic energies and personalities. And one of them said that he was a channeler for Native Americans, and each one of us had a Native American spirit that was in charge of us. And so mine was named Brown Bear. And Brown Bear gave me the advice. He said, you were meditating through this channel, through this medium. And I hadn't said anything about that I was a meditator, but I was. And you're meditating, and you should continue on that path, and you will make spiritual progress in this lifetime. And I thought, well, that's interesting. They knew about I had been a meditator. Might have been a good guess, but nevertheless, they guessed right. And I had others, you went from one to another, and they give you different advice and so on. And I definitely didn't feel drawn in that. It was an interesting experience, but I didn't feel drawn in that direction to continue going there. And then one day, there was a small group of us going to college, and we were all seeking something higher and better. And there was a friend who said, Charlie, this individual, had met somebody. And they were kind of like a mother or a grandmother. And I thought, well, that's not what I'm looking for. You know, I was thinking a yogi, long hair and a beard and so on. Somebody who's fit for the script. And this didn't sound like the right character for me, but they insisted that I must come. So finally I agreed, and we all piled in the car. And we came. And it was Mother Hamilton. And so I sat, and I was sitting in full lotus posture those days, and I went up in front and sat down in full lotus posture. And Mother began to speak. And I just felt a spiritual power from her emanating through her words and through her being. And she used the word God. And before that, if somebody had said the word God, I was pretty much looking for the nearest exit. But Mother said it and used the word in such a way that I knew that it was different than I had listened to before. And it didn't put me off at all. And she used terms like Christ consciousness. Well, I'd never heard of that before. But again, it sounded intriguing. So I didn't understand many of the things that she was talking about. But I felt her spiritual power emanating from her, and I felt uplifted. And I had long hair at the time, and I felt like my hair might be just being blown back straight like in a windstorm. It was so powerful like that. And so I was done, and I stood in line, and Mother hugged everybody at the end. And so I stood in line waiting with everyone else. And as I got closer, my heart just started pounding so hard, and I didn't know why. It just was. And I got up to her. And I looked in her eyes, And then she hugged me. And the next thing I really remembered was being in the back seat of the car that I came in, and with the other people that we had come with. And apparently Mother had talked about renunciation that night, and they were in good humor talking about stopping at Baskin and Robbins to start our life of renunciation of this world. And they were having a good laugh, and we did stop at Baskin and Robbins for some ice cream. But when I heard them and became aware of them, it was as if I was looking at them through a telescope 1,000 miles away. They seemed so distant. And I realized at that moment something had really happened when I had received this hug from this woman that I'd never met before. And I thought to myself at the time, I want to get to the bottom of this. And so I kept coming back. And each time I would test it, and will I feel uplifted? Will I feel the spiritual power emanating from this tremendous God woman that I had met? And I did. And I felt the upliftment. I felt the change. And it wasn't like everything just got better all of a sudden. I was still in much spiritual misery. They were like hounds that were nipping at me, nudging me and pushing me and prodding me, and not to get satisfied with myself or with this world. Excuse me. And then I started into spiritual experiences when I was with a meditation group. And suddenly I felt a snap at the base of my spine. And I felt this tremendous power go up through my spine. And it went right to the point between my eyebrows. I didn't try to direct it there, although I was thinking of it when I was meditating. But bang, it took me there. And I was like being nailed against a wall. It was powerful, and it was somewhat painful. And it was very, very hot. I felt like I could fry eggs on my forehead. It was so hot there. And this tremendous power subsisted for some period of time, perhaps 5 or 10 minutes. It's hard to tell. And then it gradually started to subside, but never completely. And from that moment on, I had this movement in my spine. Now, this is that serpent energy that Jesus spoke of. And he said, even like Moses raised the serpent, you see, Moses had a staff made of brass or brass-like material, and it had a serpent on it. And that was symbolic, you see, of the spine. And the brass is the gold of spirit. And the serpent is this upraised spiritual energy that starts at the base of your spine, down near the coccyx. And it rises up right to the point between the eyebrows, goes up to nerve plexus of the medulla oblongata, right at the base of your skull, and then it goes across to this third eye point, or the point between the eyebrows. And this is what Jesus talked about when he said, "Behold, I stand at the door." And that is the doorway to heavenly consciousness. Now, it just doesn't automatically open, and my mind didn't. But the spiritual energy was about its business. It has its own intelligence, you see. It has its own way of doing things. And so through the heat and through the pressure and through the power that it brought to bear, it started to open this center that had been long closed. It resides in all of us dormant. Now, if you look at the Egyptian kings, they're portrayed with a serpent that's coming out of that spot, the ajna, the point between the eyebrows, and then its head is lifted up higher. And this symbolizes the raised serpent force, the spiritual kundalini, as it's called in India and in yoga. And it represents the very same thing. The crown the kings wear is the crown of consciousness. And ideally, a king should be an enlightened ruler. Now, we know most times that's not the truth, but that's because we've come through these dark ages. But in the enlightened ages, kings carried a scepter, and the scepter represented the spine, the upraised spine, and the serpent force that had gone to the top, and they wore a crown. And that's the crown chakra at the top of the head. And that is when you have become an enlightened being. Then this crown, you feel it. And sometimes it feels like a heavy pressure, like you have a lead hat on top of your head. Other times it feels that it's this unfolding, and it's symbolically represented by the thousand petal lotus in India. And it's like each petal folds back, and that becomes an enlightened thought, an enlightened spiritual consciousness unfolds inside of you. It's a power that's going about its business, and you are a witness more than an actor at this point. You're watching the spiritual consciousness unfold inside of you, and it's wonderful. It's tremendous. And all of this is talked about in symbolic language in every single religion all across this world. But the reason I had this was because Mother already had this consciousness, this power, perfectly raised up inside of her. Now, she paid a tremendous price in order to have this happen. You think, well, why such a tremendous price? Shouldn't it be just something that comes to us? And one day we're in ignorance, and the next day we're enlightened. But you remember that principle of karma. As you sow, so shall you reap. And Jesus himself said that you will have to pay for everything that you've done. Every jot, every title, everything has to be paid for. And so as you reverse this current, you face yourself. You face all the things that you've done in your outward journey from God. And believe me, not all of it is nice. Not all of it is beautiful or pretty. There are some pretty terrible things that we've done in our outward journey. Many of them may be unremembered, but still, they are there, and they have to be paid for. It's like being given a credit card. And you go out, and you charge this, and you charge that, and you have a gay old time doing it. But eventually, the bill comes due. Now, this comes about through illnesses that we have in the body, or various difficulties that we have, and we're facing the things that we've done. And when we enter into this final journey, this final consciousness, then we are being uplifted. And as a result of that, we face all of these things. I'd like to read to you from something else that Master wrote. That concerns this. And he quotes from the Gita, "Over and above performing faithfully all one's duties, taking shelter in me," this is God speaking to Arjuna, "it is my pleasure a devotee obtains eternal, unchangeable state." Now, the eternal, unchangeable state is that God consciousness inside of you. And Master's commentary, "The devotee beholds God as the shelter of all creatures and himself as unsheltered by any other power. Without attachment to the fruits of his efforts, he continually engages in God-united yoga activities and all other divinely obligatory duties, just to please God. After meeting all the requirements of the laws of liberation, the yogi ultimately finds, by the freely given grace of God, by my pleasure," as Krishna had said, "by my pleasure, the eternal state of liberation. The quality of a yogi's meditation and other actions, the guru's help, and God's grace, these are the three requisites of liberation. No matter how much a devotee strives for salvation, he is required to make the effort wholeheartedly for God. That effort constitutes only 25% of the requirements for liberation. Another 25% depends on his guru's blessing, spiritually stimulating the disciple's striving. But the guru's help and the devotee's effort notwithstanding, it is necessary to have also God's grace, which may be said to constitute the remaining 50% of the requirements. God, the creator of the cosmic law of karma that binds human life, is the sole judge as to whether a devotee has fulfilled all the laws of spiritual conduct required for liberation. However, a devotee who, with the help of his guru, fulfills all the laws and then insolently expects immediate liberation will not find it. God is not a mathematical produced jackpot. But if the devotee fulfills the divine laws and also has complete love for God, in other words, take shelter in me, then all surrendering love draws his grace. Man is made in the image of God's love, and by manifesting unconditional love, he can again become like the Father, merging in him and dropping his acquired second nature as a mortal being. There's a lot that is said in a short amount of space here, and it's tremendous, it really is, that God's nature is love. And when we love God, we awaken ourselves to his greater nature. It's not that God doesn't love us, that he withholds himself from us. You know, in the Old Testament, there is certain language that is used, that God is a jealous God, that God demands this and that he punishes for that. And it's just merely a way of talking about God's law. And that when we really get onto the spiritual path, that God being a jealous God isn't that God's jealous. What does he have to be jealous of, really? He's got everything. What it means is that for us, when we focus our minds upon God, if we're diverted, if we have other things on our mind, we will not have the proper focus of attention that will bring us into that higher God consciousness. If we do not open our hearts and love God with all of our hearts, with all of our minds, with all of our souls, with all of our strength, then we will not attain unto that highest state of consciousness, because every thought, every desire is a creation. And if we're still creating the things of this world, then we're not putting our whole attention upon God. So in that sense, you can say that God is a jealous God. He demands everything from us. But it's not because he needs anything from us. It's simply that that's the principle, that's the law. We have to be willing to surrender ourselves to him, give him everything, trust that he wants what is highest and best for us. One time, Papa Ramdas was always talking about how God was immediately available, but you had to surrender yourself. You had to give everything. And he would say, that's no joke. You really have to do it. But Mataji was getting after him. And she said, you have all these people coming to you, but who's attaining realization? No one is. Now she had herself. But she's saying, nobody here is. And that's your responsibility. You're the teacher. You're responsible for them getting their complete realization. And Papa would say, what can Ram Dass do? He exhorts everyone to surrender themselves completely, but nobody's wanting or willing to do it. Mataji wouldn't give up. She says, but you're the responsible one here. What will people say of the teacher when nobody passes the class? Ram Dass said, what does he care of what other people think? And back and forth they would go. And finally, one day, Papa was sitting in a group, and I was talking to a woman one time. She had been a 16, 17-year-old girl at the time. And she had been sitting there when Papa did this. And there's a whole group sitting around Papa. Now, they had all come as devotees. They were all interested in gaining God realization. They would listen to Papa, and they would shake their heads, yes. But what were they doing about it? And so Papa said, all right, anyone who's willing to surrender their lives completely right now, come up here and Ram Dass will give them complete liberation. Everyone just sat there. Nobody moved. Nobody said a word. Papa said a second time. He says, Ram Dass is offering now. Come forward. Come here now. Be willing to surrender absolutely everything. And Ram Dass will give you the divine touch. Nobody moved. Nobody said a thing. A third time the offer was made. Again, nobody moved. Nobody said anything. Ram Dass said, all right, offer is withdrawn. And this woman, who was in her 60s at the time that I was talking to her, and had been this girl at the time, she said, I wanted to be a teacher. And that's the first thing that came up to my mind. And I didn't want to let go of that idea to be a teacher. Now, it never dawned on her that it could be God inside of her who wanted her to be a teacher. And it wouldn't have interfered at all to have her realization and to be a teacher as well. But that's not the way that she thought at the time. And so she remembered why she didn't go up. She wasn't willing to toss everything into the ocean yet. And so later on, Mataji had not been there when Papa did this, but Ram Dass was telling her about it. And she said, Papa, you can fool others, but you can't fool me. On the outside, you were saying, come forward and I will give you realization. On the inside, you were making everyone sit there, be mum, and not move a stitch. You can't fool me. It is still up to you to give everyone realization. So this is the play that they had. It is no joke, in one sense, to go all the way to God realization. But oh, what we get in return. The kingdom of heaven is within you, said the Christ. And he spoke the truth. And yet, we are satisfied with the paltry things of the kingdom of this world. We don't really listen to the words. We don't really respond and do what we must in order to have that state of realization. Now I know what Master said here is the absolute truth, that Guru's grace needs to be there. When I was sitting there meditating, there is no way that I knew what to do or had the power to start this Kundalini force inside of me. It happened all of its own accord. And I know it happened because of Mother. I also know that God's grace and power is absolutely necessary. Human effort alone is not up to the deed. The human ego cannot transcend the human ego. Now, we can't even know how to digest our own food. And yet we eat the food, and there are mechanisms that go to work inside of us, complex mechanisms. On the organ level, on the cellular level, it's really amazing when you think about it. We take it for granted, unless something upsets our tummy. Otherwise, it just all goes to work. This intelligence is at work. How do you explain that kind of intelligence? How do you explain the complexity of this human body? Is all of that random chance? That defies all logic, all reason. It is tremendous, the design of this body. And yet, this body and this world is just merely a footstool of God. He rests his feet upon it. He is so much more, and there are kingdoms that are so much more than this material world. There is bliss. There is light. There is spiritual understanding. There are kingdoms far vaster than anything this material realm could possibly even hint at. And yet we remain satisfied with these paltry things. Now we still have a life to live. And that is God inside of you too. We assume that God is not of this world, and yet if God had not become this world, where did it come from? It is all made up of God stuff. The atoms, the electrons, the subatomic particles, all part and parcel of God stuff. It has to be, because there is but one sole creator. There is but one sole power, one sole intelligence. And it has all come from that. And it is a vast display, a wonderful display. And yet, residing right inside of us is something so much greater, so much more profound than even to be found on the outside and in this world, this marvelous, wonderful world of creation. And that is what we are about. That is what we seek. Now, most of the world runs mad after money, after sex, after fame, after all the things of this world, with barely an idea that there might be anything else. And even if they have the idea, they're not really interested. What they really want are the things of this world. As the comedian said, he said, "I have always heard that money can't buy you happiness. I would just like to have enough to make sure and prove that that's true." And that's the way most people are. They just think happiness is around the corner. When I have that perfect health, when I have that perfect job, when I have that perfect wealth, then I'll be happy. And yet, where do we find it at? Where do we find those people who attain that perfect happiness? Few and far between. It really comes from entering into and becoming established into that inner kingdom of heaven, right within our own beings, right inside of you, lying dormant, but just as real, just as beautiful, just as perfect as it ever was, as it ever will be. It is your eternal gift. And you cannot destroy it. As Krishna says in the Gita, fire cannot burn it. Water cannot drown it. It cannot be stayed or changed in any way. Because it is a perfect gift given to every one of us. And no matter how dastardly we might be in life, no matter how despicable we may treat our fellow man, we cannot change that perfect gift because it is eternal. I cannot tell you the gratitude that I feel in my heart for Mother, because without her, I don't even want to imagine what my life may have been like. All I have to do is look around and see certain people's lives who seem to be lost. And I would have certainly been that. But she changed my life. She awakened that serpent force and reversed its course from being downward into being upward. And it has taken me on a tremendous journey, and the journey has not ceased. In fact, it's an eternal journey as long as we hold any sense of self of I. Because God is constantly unfolding himself before us. When we say that God is infinite, it's just a word, really, isn't it? We can't really know what being infinite is. But what we can deduce from it is that it's never ending. And never ending in an absolutely positive, good, uplifting, transforming kind of way. That we can explore God's great body as long as we hold any sense of individuality. He continues to reveal Himself to us. And then we merge into Him. And we know the vastness and the stillness of that state. And then He can manifest back out as creation again, you see? Can happen again and again. But we don't need to get lost along the way. We don't need to get attached to anything. We can remain free beings. The East, this is called Jiva Mukta. Freed while living as a living soul. And you can live free like that. And still, you breathe. You live in this body. You operate as many other people do. But everything has changed because you are now established in your oneness with God. So let us lift our eyes to the heaven. Let us trust that in our surrender to God, He will do everything that's exactly right for our souls. Everything that's exactly right for us. He will fulfill all of our heart's desires. And if there's something for you to accomplish in this life, He will guide you along in that way. You do not need to be afraid that you're going to miss out on life. Because as Mother would say, God is life and life is God. And you think of Mother, you think of Master, you don't think of people who live life halfway. They live life full way. All, everything inside of them. They live full lives. But they live total God lives. And therein lies all the difference, and we are all the beneficiaries as a result. Will you please pray with me? Oh, Heavenly Father. Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection. Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. I bow to the great light within you.